Sunday Night Saffron, a babble about religion, politics, and all things ethnic, with John Saffron and Father Bob Maguire.
And all things paranormal and all things supernatural. Father Bob, welcome.
Thank you.
Oh, my God, on today's show.
I'm paranormal.
We're going to have Dr. Vladimir DeBarge. He's the founder of the Australian Parapsychological Research Association of Australia. And he reckons, even though I don't think he thinks he's seen a ghost himself, that all these paranormal things can be measured scientifically. Anyway, that's what he's out to do. Graham Hancock, best-selling British investigative author of Fingerprints of the Gods. You know, he's taken ayahuasca.
Ah, see what I mean? That's what he's on for.
Hallucinogenics.
Yes.
And he's met
the gods.
The mother goddess.
Ah.
Who made him change his life.
Yeah.
Anyway, he's going to be telling us all about consciousness.
Yeah.
And how to telepathy. Of sorts.
Oh, that's nice, isn't it?
With other worlds and other beings.
Mm.
Finally, we're going to be talking to a man, Robert Bruce, and he's going to tell you about if you've got a demon, how to get it out, like practical things you can do right now if you have a demon inside of you.
Right.
He's had a demon inside of you, him.
You're listening to Sunday Night Saffron on Triple J.
Father Bob.
Is he bringing a demon into the studio, did you say?
That sting was... to kind of like, that's like the full stop. So then we move on to another topic.
Yeah, that was a paranormal experience. It wasn't me. I didn't say anything. Did you hear a noise?
No, go on.
You hear something?
Yes.
I didn't say a thing.
Bob, can I show you something? Oh, go on. Please go on.
No, I'm finished.
Okay,
if you heard something then, I'm out of here.
I didn't say anything. Look at this, Bob.
Oh, God, what are you going to do? Don't take anything off. I can't stand it.
No, just describe what's happening now.
He's dragging his right leg, ladies and gentlemen, as though he was, like me, a cripple. Now, are you having a go at me or what?
Oh, I'm not faking it, Father Bob.
Oh, hello.
I have a hobble.
A hobble, have you? A real hobble?
A real hobble that I got yesterday. Guess how I got this? I've had a version of this problem before. I'm in my flat. I'm sort of like just shuffling a bit because I'm kind of thinking. Because you've seen, I go like walk around and say, and I was getting really angry, like really furious about a thing I will not be bringing up.
No, don't bring it
up. But I'm just so furious. And at the peak of my fury, suddenly, like a tendon, a muscle, I don't know about the body.
Yeah.
I'm only into exorcisms and the supernatural. Yeah. But something in my, that's the calf, the lower bit, isn't it? Yeah, something in my calf.
Went.
And then I just had to like hobble. I went to the Jonah from Tonga.
Ah,
launch.
Yes.
I had to like hobble all the way down there, hobble around to get my glass of champagne, hobble. But this has happened to me. And do you know what the interesting thing was? I was thinking about tweeting about the thing I was furious about. And this was like...
Don't do it.
This was the universe or my body saying,
don't do it.
Don't do it. And I just knew I shouldn't tweet out of fury.
We don't need these guests today.
Mm.
You've experienced it yourself.
I can't tell you. This has happened to me at least four times before, a version of this. I remember being really furious about this guy. And I was like, and it was a similar thing. I was like, I'm just going to get him. I don't know.
Yes.
Maybe I should ring him. No. Maybe I'll... I'll get his JPEG off Google Images. Pang. You know how many followers I've got, mate? I'm going to put you up there. I'm going to take you down, you mother... I was like that. And then, like...
You must, bro.
I rolled my ankle.
Look at this, Heather.
It's like my body telling me, don't... tweet that.
I think it's called psychosomatic.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Psychosomatic. The state of mind affecting the soma, which, as we all know, is the body.
Yes.
So there you are, living... Are you sure we should have these people on the program today? Because you're a living example, for God's sake, of it.
The might have a demon in my calf.
Well, it could well be. You see?
Dear listeners, stick around.
A decaffeinated calf.
This is Triple J.
Sunday Night Saffron.
On Triple J.
There's going to be so much supernatural and paranormal spirits floating through the
radio. I feel it.
We're going to be talking to the one and only Graham Hancock, a big name in this scene, by the way. And he's going to be talking about using ayahuasca. Have I finally learned to pronounce that after?
I don't know. You used it.
To connect to the goddess mother and how it can turn your life around, even get you off hard drugs. If you're currently listening to this on a train and you're on ice, for instance, and you're squawking at your partner who's on ice and everyone's freaked out in the carriage, you should listen to this because he's saying you can use ayahuasca to get off ice. And we're going to be speaking to a man who's going to teach you how to get rid of a demon inside of you, if you have a demon inside of you. And we're also, we've got the scientific person on. He's going to tell us whether you can measure supernatural
stuff. Oh, thank you.
Stuff. Father Bob, I was cheating on you with another priest.
Aha, I knew it sooner or later.
I was at the Greek Orthodox Church of St. George, and I was talking to the Reverend Father Dimitri. And I was at his church. I'd wandered in because on the street outside his church was where there was this white nationalist rally going on. This was in South Brisbane. And, of course, if there's going to be some freaking white nationalist rally on, as if I'm not going to be on the first plane up there in my press hat with my little notebook and dictaphone to be the gumshoe reporter for the for one of the newspapers. So obviously we're talking about racists because that was happening outside. And he was saying something that I've noticed too, which he says in some cases that he's dealt with, because he was into he'd like done mental health studies and stuff like that. That people who are like extreme racists can like have, mental issues that whatever, like extreme narcissism and bipolar and delusions that kind of go into that area.
Yeah.
And I've always noticed that too, and that kind of connected a lot of dots to me because I sometimes feel empathy towards people who have these odious, I'm hanging out with them and I'm kind of warming. And I reckon that's it because you see they're vulnerable. You know, if you're around someone and they've got like some mental issues.
Yes.
You can feel a warmth and empathy towards them. So that's that. That's why I always feel that's why I feel like cuddling a Klansman sometimes.
Ah, I see.
And that's cuddle with 3 Ks.
Thank you to the Greek Orthodox Church in South Brisbane for bringing that
The other side of that is my observation. I've met two Holocaust deniers in my travels, and my amateur psych, I don't have any qualifications, but I did actually think they had mental health issues. And the point being, is the way you deal with people with mental health issues different to how you treat people if you just think, oh, they're just like beyond redemption, racists and awful. So for instance, in the case of Frederick Tobin, who's an Australian who ended up in jail because he posted Holocaust revisionist material, and then he got taken to the courts, racial vilification. Anyway, and he didn't take it down, so contempt of court, and he ended up 3 months in jail. It's kind of like, well, if a person is mentally unhealthy, is that really what should happen? That people should be locked away?
So you're saying they're mad rather than bad?
Well, I'm not saying that. I'm just saying that the way you think about what kind of punishment.
Yes.
I'm just throwing it up in the air. I've no answers. I'm just sort of like in my amateur studies, what I've picked up in the flypaper of my mind.
Well, what are you going to do there?
No, because this is a problem. Like, you're never allowed to like just, even if they're lived observations, you're never allowed to just like throw it into the ether and go, I'll toss this about. I don't really have an answer.
That's right.
Because I don't have an answer. I'm not saying that means you're left racist off the hook. I'm just saying this is what, in my lived life, I've observed.
And well, even if they're mentally ill, you can prosecute them.
Yeah, sure.
We've got no alternative in this country because I don't think we're equipped to deal with people as health issues. Well, we are, because we've got a prison, haven't we, that is in fact dedicated to criminal behaviour, which is diagnosed as...
Of course, another layer to that is...
Mental illness.
There might be Klansmen listening now who are, you know, just sitting there on their rocking chair, on their porch, listening to the live stream. They're in Georgia in
they're
the
listening
south,
as we
the,
speak.
Yeah, as we speak. Mm. And yeah, listening to the live stream. They might be. They would say, hang on, John, what you're doing is like really Orwellian, because you're accusing anyone who has dissident views of being mentally ill.
Thank you.
So I'm actually the one, the creepy one with the problem.
Mm.
Man, you're the one wearing the hood.
Yes.
Goddamn chasing around people with your
putting crosses.
Like, yes, they don't. Cause they, anyway, many layers to the whole mental health versus racism blah.
Mm.
Anyway.
That's that's interesting. Very interesting.
Sunday Night Saffron.
Triple J.
Father Bob Maguire.
Yeah, we've missed song too.
No. Did you know there's controversy in the debating scene in America?
No.
You know, like those classic debating things, like at colleges and you have the two sides.
Yes,
and it's,
yes.
That the capital punishment should be reintroduced.
Thank
and
you
have
yes.
these three well-spoken people on that side.
Republicans,
and,
yes.
And they back and forth, back and forth.
Mm.
Apparently, whilst all of us haven't been noticing, because we've been off just staring at our smartphones for the past 10 years, apparently the debating scene in America has totally changed. And this isn't just like little side, little off-Broadway debating things. This is like the main game. There's something called the Cross-Examination Debate Association Championships, and that's like the biggest college debating competition. And the students who won this year were two African-American women. And let's have a listen to some of their debate.
Yeah, that's nice.
They say the nigga's always already queer. That's exactly the point. It means that the impact is that is an impact turn to the that it is a case turn to the affirmative, because we are saying that queer bodies are not able to survive. That it necessarily means that the body of the nigga is not able to survive.
And when the nigga sees these pains and suffering, that he can only envision himself, that he does not see another nigga that he can feel sympathy for or embrace, but rather that otherness gets obliterated.
What's going on?
What's going on? It sounds more like sort of like spoken word. So even though it's sounding a bit stumbly,
yes. that's
like this intention. Like a spoken word artist would get up on the microphone, like Gil Scott Heron, you know, the revolution will not be televised or whatever. So apparently that style has taken over. So so her team was like that, but the other team was also like that. So it wasn't like, it's not like these girls who won, they ended up winning the national thing. It's not like, oh, that's their shtick and they're some thing. It's like their opposition came up, and part of him, he came up and he broke into some Tupac. And that's actually the less controversial part of it, because that's just about style. Apparently substance-wise, the new thing in debating, and which is causing all this controversy, is everyone getting all meta and like deconstructing what the question is and then not answering the question and bending it so they can answer what they want. So in the case of this, the resolution asked whether the US president's war powers should be restricted. Rather than address the resolution straight on, the two women who won, along with the other team, attacked its premise. The more pressing issue, they argued, is how the US government is at war with poor black communities. So the debate question, you know, was about the US government. Should you be bombing Afghanistan and Iraq? And they're like, oh, well, that's not the question that should be asked. And then sort of doing all that and then making it all about the war on the black poor. And then...
And getting away with it, though. I mean, that's acceptable...
Well, they won. But and the controversy is that this new meta thing where, because again, this isn't apparently the first time, it's like the new thing, is whether, you should just freaking answer the debate
that's
question.
Right, that's right, yeah.
And the point of debating is that you should be able to debate both sides.
Yes, that's right.
So you should just be able to throw up, you can't just like bend everything.
Nah.
And then the, what's the other point? The other point is, the other controversy is. Oh, that's right. It's talking about lived-in experiences.
Mm.
Apparently, the new thing in debating is you talk about your own experiences in life, which apparently in conventional debating you never do. So if you're debating the joys of or the benefits of capital punishment, you don't open the debate in a conventional sense by going, oh, when my auntie was killed by the killer,
yes,
I was really sad, and that's when I began. You're not meant to do that, and so now debating is being infused with these lived-in experiences.
No good as an Oxford debate.
Well, I don't know.
I think the British would apply the rules.
I guess there's two ways to look at it. One, apparently they're way more interesting than they used to be, so you've got to give that up.
Yeah.
Two, there is an element of US, my stance, that when we talk about Americans, there is this kind of like American self-focus that doesn't go away just because you're in a minority in America. Like you're still very... You've got that American thing of everything being self-focused.
Yes,
so you
yes.
could argue that you should be able to, if the debate question is about bombing people in the Middle East,
yes.
working around that, like maybe you should step outside yourself and freaking debate that. Like it's a very narrow way of looking
I
at the world.
I can understand.
That there's nothing to look at it besides my personal experience,
yes.
even if my personal experience has elements of oppression.
Mm. Yes, yes. Well, I understand what you're saying. I do it myself, and you've accused me of doing it.
Which is what?
If the debate was something about asylum seekers, boats, I would then spin it and say, whatever about asylum seekers in boats, we have asylum seekers in our own cities and towns because they have been rejected by mainstream. Then you'd say, Bob, get back to the point. We're talking about asylum seekers, real asylum seekers in the real sea. Between here and Indonesia, because Bob has pinched it and used it to suit his own need for a discussion on right here, right now. So I accept that. I know what you're talking about. Thank you. I'll still do it, though.
Sunday Night Safran.
With John Safran and Father Bob Maguire on Triple J.
Still to come tonight, we've got Graham Hancock, who says that ayahuasca, an hallucinogen, could lead to a global change in the attitude to consciousness if you take it.
Yeah.
Hope you bring some in. Do you reckon he's got some in his...
He may have.
Hmm. And we're also going to meet a man. If you've got a demon, we have a guy on later who actually will give you practical advice of how to drive out demons.
Yeah.
And I think you can do it on your own. I don't think he's like... Hey, come to my little, house. Yes, don't come to my... what you're doing right at the moment, lying there under your doona, just with that, and a few household items, such as crucifix.
Oh, yes, or little...
Holy water.
Or little dolls to stick pins in.
But now it's time for our first guest. Father Bob, please...
He just walked out because he thinks we're both mad.
Go on, introduce our guest.
Vladimir.
Yes.
Dubai.
Correct.
Thank you.
Do you want to say what he does?
Well, I mean, you've got I'm not going to say too much about what he does because I'm too nervous.
He's the founder of the Australian Parapsychological Research Association
of Australia.
Hang on, there's two Australians there. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Now, what is the purpose of the foundation?
Essentially, looking at all aspects of the paranormal. So it was essentially formed to look at primarily phenomena related to consciousness or the possibility of survival of consciousness beyond the body.
And so what does that mean in practical terms? Is that like, so therefore there are ghosts out there because that's the consciousness of people after they've passed on?
The possibility of ghosts, yeah. There's plenty of anecdotal reports. There's plenty of people reporting their experiences, that they've experienced something suggestive of ghost activity, perhaps deceased relatives coming back or just their houses not feeling quite right. And if you filter through the noise, you'll find that there are some reports which, genuinely do seem to be of a paranormal nature.
And when did you first become interested in this? As a child, were you like interested in?
I would have been probably high school when I was in high school. I came across some books about out of body experiences of all things. And that's kind of when the thought of, hang on, it's the possibility that something exists outside of the body when you go to sleep or when you have this out of body experience, and you get to travel around, and just the idea that consciousness doesn't have to be always connected to the body. Was something that really kind of grasping.
And what kind of subjects did you do in high school? Because you're coming from were you like a science kid?
Yeah, yeah. Science, chemistry, physics, mathematics was probably my favourite subject.
So those two things were like happening in parallel. You're very interested in the sciences and you're interested in this out-of-body...
Yes, although I was drawn to the sciences. I wouldn't say I was particularly gifted in that area, but I was more interested in understanding how things work. So the mechanisms underlying the out-of-body experience. You know, if you can do this, how does it occur? You know, under what conditions does it work? And what actually is the consciousness, as we call it?
And so are you trying to put scientific rigor to these claims and then deciding whether... Are you like ultimately, do you want to be able to produce some paperwork or some proof that there are these out-of-body experiences?
Absolutely. So far the group's focus has actually been on all aspects of consciousness, but we have been focusing quite a bit on ghost research, because that's actually where we get most phone calls coming in. We've had a few contacts with people with out of body experiences, but it's actually very difficult to find someone who can come into a lab or whatever and actually induce this thing at will. There's very few people who can do that, so it's very difficult to actually do active research.
And so, what's one of the more solid ghost stories you've been told that you've kind of researched and decided, oh, there might be something there?
Ghost research?
Yes.
I've got a few personal experiences that we've encountered over there, because we've been doing this for about 6 or 7 years or so. Overall, we find that there's a lot of... It's almost 95% or so psychological. There's a lot of psychology involved, and you can kind of explain away a lot of ghost activity or haunting activity through mundane explanations. But when you filter all that out, then there's always a couple of things that you just cannot explain. And we've had all manner of we've had visual, auditory, tactile kind of phenomena occurring.
Like what's an example though?
The first thing I ever encountered was actually a visual one, and it was.
And when you say I encounter, is that you personally or encountering someone who's encountered it?
No, myself personally.
Oh, yeah.
So we were at an old abandoned kind of mental asylum, and about 2 or 3 in the morning, I was getting pretty tired.
Where was the mental asylum?
It was, I'm not sure if I'm allowed to say, am I?
Oh, okay.
Illegally, you might be allowed to say.
Okay, fair enough. You don't have to say. What about the city or the state or something?
It's in Victoria. So
okay, cool.
All the research we've done is in Victoria or Tasmania. And it was just myself and a colleague, and we were both sitting there, just pitch dark. The room didn't have any electricity or lighting, and we just literally in the doorway there was this orange orb, essentially an orange glowing light, just pulsating. It was about the size of a basketball, pale orange, just flickering on and off. And when I first saw it myself, I thought it's just my imagination. I'm just imagining it. And I was going to discount it until I mentioned it to my colleague. He looked over and saw it as well. And that's kind of when we thought, hang on, there is something in the room there. And first thing we thought, hang on, we've got intruders. Someone's in the grounds with a torch. And we started looking around. But we discounted every possibility. We thought it might be car lights, a helicopter with a spotlight, somebody with a torch. But we essentially eliminated all the possibilities. And to this day, we still don't know exactly what caused it.
Wow, because all the pesky scientists will say just because you can't explain something doesn't mean you can fill that gap in knowledge with what you want it to be.
Correct, yeah. I have to agree. I mean, all things, on balance, you'd have to say that ghosts don't exist. But to do that, you then have to dismiss every single claim that people have made. And overall, I kind of believe that even if one of those claims is true, then it's worthwhile looking into. I can't just dismiss it like most other scientists do.
And why do you, like people who are religious, they've got like good explanations. They kind of like close the loop of about explaining why, for instance, there's angels or there's this supernatural stuff, because it all comes back to God and all, it's all going towards, you know, Armageddon or whatever. And that, anyway, they've got this whole explanation for why there are these things. Do you have like an explanation for why there are ghosts?
No, and I try and stay away from it, actually. I mean, other than general ideas about the categories of ghosts. So, for example, you might have the ghosts which are considered to be the some sort of spirit or consciousness of deceased relatives or deceased humans who remain behind. A lot of them remain behind due to the manner of their death being very violent or very sudden, and they you get the impression that they still have something to complete on the planet. Then there are those these kind of residual kind of ghosts which don't seem to exhibit any type of consciousness or interaction with anybody else in the kind of human realm. And then you also have quite often reports of kind of non-human activity, non-human ghosts, these kind of shadow people that people report, or short kind of stature people that exhibit more kind of creature-like activity than anything else. So other than that, which kind of helps direct our research, I try not to actually try to get too many ideas in my head as to, you know, how many other ethereal realms there are or how many astral realms there are, because it really doesn't help me to obtain the evidence or to actually, you know, come to any real conclusions.
And do you think, what's like the best evidence you have compiled?
Look, I have to say, at the forefront, when I first started doing this, I was invited to go on an investigation. Before that, I went on YouTube and looked at all these ghost adventures and all the video footage. And the first time I went on an investigation, I thought, oh, my God, I'm going to have to pack extra underwear. I literally packed extra underwear because I thought I was going to, you know, have some kind of a serious scare. Mm. But it's quite the opposite. It's just 8 to 12 hours of pretty much boredom looking around. But so, you know, over the 7 or so years of research, you actually find that there might be 4 or 5 things that once you experience things at every investigation, but if you consider it scientifically and skeptically, you can exclude almost everything. So overall, we've got perhaps 5 or 6 credible reports, and the most credible would be one where it was strictly controlled. We actually had two groups of two people in opposite ends of a building, and one person in the middle controlling the monitoring the environment, and we just heard this male exhale, like a deep exhale, and it wasn't heard just by a single person. It was actually heard by both groups at opposite ends of the house at the same time, but it wasn't picked up by the person sitting in the middle who was monitoring all the audio. And more interestingly, both groups heard it at the same time within about a metre of them. They both reported that it was within a metre or so of themselves. And neither group actually knew that the other group heard it. So it was all confirmed through walkie-talkies in the end. And that's the most interesting, because we can't explain how it was heard in the two rooms but not in the corridors connecting them. And we try to consider the possibility of rodents in the floor or possums in the ceiling, but again, the roofs in those two joining those two rooms weren't the same.
And when you were going right back to being very young, were you into like ghost stories when you were like a child, or did your parents tell you stories that?
Not at all.
Really?
No,
so just it first came to you when you were in high school.
Yeah, I didn't have any real particular interest in ghost stories or anything until one day when I read that book about out-of-body experiences.
Mm, wow. Yeah. Now, if people have had any hauntings or the like, they should contact the Parapsychological Research Association of Australia.
Yeah, the Australian Parapsychological Research Association, APRA.
And you'll come down with your ghost-busting suit, won't you? With the...
Yeah, that costs extra. No, no. I should just say it's all non-profit. We're a non-profit organisation, so we don't charge. But I can wear a costume if you like.
And just before we go, we have a sound of a ghost that we'll be hearing very soon. Bob, did you have any questions for our
guess. No, I just wanted to know if these ghosts were of any earthly use.
And what do you mean by that, Father Bob?
Well, simply because I found myself saying as a funeral celebrant, ladies and gentlemen, the remains are in the coffin. We take the best of our loved one with us. Now, am I talking about taking a ghost with us?
Probably.
So I find that... Thank you.
So you're saying that any Ghostbusters listening, maybe you shouldn't be chasing off the ghost. Maybe you should be...
Maybe they're on our side.
Yes. Anyway, here we go. We're going to have a listen. Vladimir, do you want... Dr. Vladimir, do you want to ask... put any kind of context to this?
Yeah. The audio that's going to be played in a minute was actually acquired at the J Ward, museum now. It used to be the asylum for the criminally insane, I think it is,
yes.
Or the prison for the criminally insane.
Yeah.
And just to give people an idea, this is a brick or a stone building. There are no settling noises. There's no creaking or anything like that. And you know, in the 10 or 12 hours that you're there, there's not a single noise other than the ones you make yourself. And so... During the night, about 10 or 11 o'clock at night, we had two people in the main corridor where all the prison cells are, and the following is essentially what they heard.
So, dear listeners, take a listen to this.
The sound travels in these buildings like crazy. Okay, that wasn't. What the freaking hell? Is anyone down there? Okay, I don't know what that was.
So there you go, Bob.
Yeah, it sounds like...
Still happy with ghosts hovering all around us?
Yes, I don't mind. I think they're, you know... They're obviously using Morse code.
That woman wasn't the ghost, though. She was just the person getting...
No, there were two of the researchers there, and what they reported hearing was actually like the doors in the prison cells,
yeah,
sequentially closing one after the other. So just banging.
Well, thank you for scaring the heck out of everyone listening on Sunday night under their doonas or driving alone at night in their...
semi-trailers.
Thank you very much for joining us, Dr. Vladimir Dubai.
Thank you.
Sunday Night Safran.
On Triple J.
Father Bob.
Yes, Bort.
I was working with the Carlisle Street Palestinian this week. Don't look at me like
that. What do you mean, Palestinian?
Yeah, the Carlisle Street Palestinian.
What, a newspaper?
No. A person.
Oh. Is there only one Palestinian in Carlisle Street?
Only one I've discovered.
Oh, that's your point. That's your point. Thank you.
But I met the Carlisle Street Palestinian many years ago, at a party, in fact. And anyway, I sometimes need, like, transcripts typed up. Anyway, because, like, when I went to that white nationalist rally, I'm, like, interviewing all these people, right? And then I sit there and someone else, we type it out, all the interviews anyway. And anyway, so she... sometimes comes over to my house and helps me type out all the stuff. And she tells me about how, because, you know, how can we not, me a Jew, her Palestinian, not always fall into conversations about our various insane relatives. And she tells me about her, she's got a very anti-Semitic aunt that she tells me about all the time. And the story she told me this time was that her anti-Semitic aunt is convinced that her Jewish doctor is trying to poison her. And so she said to her aunt, like, well, what if you think he's trying to poison you, like, why not just go to an Arab doctor? And she said, yes, but Jewish doctors are the best.
Oh, my God, isn't it? It's beautiful. It's beautiful. Huh? Isn't it?
Her actual identity is actually more interesting than that, but she's made me promise not to identify her.
No, don't do that.
On the radio, because she...
So they're surely to God.
By the way, anyone I bump into in the street during the week, you've got to tell me, like, the limitations of what I'm allowed to talk about you on the radio, or else I'm just going to assume I'm just allowed to blab about anything.
Yeah. So there is only one Palestinian in Balaclava.
Well, I'm not. How do I know if there's only? I'm just telling you.
This is the only one
that I know
you
of.
Have, thank you.
Did you watch Jonah?
No, but I trumpeted Jonah at a school that I was at and said, so that they would think, oh, hello, the old priest knows, things like that.
Yeah, go on.
Bloody fool.
Anyway,
of course, I'm there at the school the night that the thing went on.
Yeah, so you asked the kids.
I can't say much. Yeah, I asked the kids. Their eyes lit up at least that they thought, because I asked the teachers previous to that, have you in fact What do you think of the Jonah?
Yeah, and what did they say?
Oh, well, the teachers were saying, oh, it's very close to the truth. Very close to the truth.
Mm.
And I thought, oh, well, that's an interesting comment from the teachers.
But did the teachers say very close to the truth, particularly because Tongan students are like that, or just boys in general?
Boys in general, but also, no, I don't think they was being specific about islanders, because I actually asked them, what's the number of islanders in this particular secondary school? And I don't think it is great.
There was a Tongan community representative who spoke to News Limited or whatever, mm-hmm. and she was complaining about the show. But it was kind of interesting because she wasn't really complaining about the things you'd expect. Like, she wasn't saying, oh, look, I find it offensive that he's puts on black makeup or whatever.
All that. What was she complaining about?
She was saying that there's sort of like the way that the her community works, for instance, the boys would be quite respectful of their elders, mm-hmm. and that therefore this show kind of presents, she's worried that the wider Australian community will think her community are made up of people who are like disrespectful to their elders. I'm not sure people see the show like that.
No, I don't think so, would they?
Yeah, I think people see the show like he, on that level, like he just represents teenage boys who are obnoxious. And also, it strikes me as not entirely credible that amongst her community that all the young boys are very respectful of their elders all the time or whatever. It seems like more credible that there'd be smart alecks and hormone-bouncing boys.
But maybe not expressed intra-family.
But even she said that all the young Tongan people that she knows in Australia like it. So she was, even her criticising it, was saying that and that was her other problem. She was worried that the younger kids would be influenced by it and think they can speak back to their parents and teachers.
Well, we'll wait and see.
I guess
I'll do some research. What are you doing? You're doing detective work. I shall do travelling journalist work as I go around the secondary schools.
I've got to do some more detective work on Jonah, actually, because there was a scene in the first episode where in the background two faces were blurred out. And I was at the Jonah launch and I elbowed the producer and I said, how come those two people are blurred out in the background of that shot? And she said that, she goes, oh, we generally like to do that because that mimics what happens in actual documentaries and actual reality TV. But then she said to me, although in this particular case, and then someone came in and interrupted us, and I never got to the end of the sentence.
Oh, dear.
I'll have to report back next week,
dear listeners,
about why in this particular case they're blurred for some other reason. Now, Father Bob, pretty soon we're going to meet the man who was banned from the TED Talks YouTube channel. You know TED Talks, that's where people come up. Like Bill Gates says, this is how we're going to solve world hunger.
Yeah, I can't see why somebody would be banned.
Well, Graham Hancock was banned because scientists afterwards and quote-unquote rationalists were saying, why are you giving a floor to someone like Graham Hancock who doesn't have scientific rigour, yet he's presenting his talk as if it has scientific rigour? Anyway, here's a clip from his banned TED Talk.
After 6 million years of boredom, the evolutionary ascent of our species from the last common ancestor with the chimpanzee, something extraordinary happened to us less than 100,000 years ago, which, by the way, is long after we'd become anatomically modern. It was a kind of emergence into consciousness less than 100,000 years ago, really less than 40,000 years ago, when we became fully symbolic creatures. And this great change has been defined as the single most important step forward in the evolution of human behavior, is intimately associated with the emergence of the great and transcendent rock and cave art all around the world.
We'll meet him after this.
You're listening to Sunday Night Safran on Triple J.
Soon we'll be talking about negative energy and so-called demons, but first we welcome best-selling writer, broadcaster, and newly controversial TED talker, Graham Hancock. Hey, Graham, how are you?
Hi, nice to see you.
I know we spoke over down the line about a year and a bit ago.
We did, indeed.
And here you are in real life. Now, Maybe just to, one of the best ways to explain where you're coming from is to talk about one of your journeys, I guess. And so could you give the listeners like a background to your 2011 journey where you went to the Amazon, was it?
Brazil, in fact, not to the Amazon.
Not
southern,
to the Amazon.
Southern Brazil.
To
for a series of ayahuasca sessions.
Yes.
Look, I've been drinking ayahuasca since 2003, and I initially started working with ayahuasca purely as a research project. I was writing a book that concerned shamanism and altered states of consciousness, and obviously and I needed to know what I was talking about. So
and ayahuasca, what's that generally?
Well, ayahuasca means the vine of the soul or the vine of the dead. It's a Quechua word, but the origin of the brew is in the Amazon. It is a brew. It's a tea. Made of two plants, typically. One of them is the ayahuasca vine, and the other is a bush that they call chacruna in the Amazon. It's called Psychotria viridis botanically. The leaves of the bush contain dimethyltryptamine, DMT, the most powerful psychedelic known to man. Normally, DMT is not orally active. You have to smoke it or inject it in order to get the effects, because there's an enzyme in our stomachs that switches off DMT on contact, and that enzyme is called monoamine oxidase. In the Amazon, they make it orally active by cooking it up with the ayahuasca vine, which contains a monoamine oxidase inhibitor. So it's a rather clever bit of ethnopharmacology which is going on here, selecting these two plants out of 150,000 different plants and trees in the Amazon, cooking them together and producing orally active DMT. Now, DMT smoked will take you on a rocket ship to the other side of reality in a fraction of a second, and it'll keep you there for no more than 12 minutes usually. DMT in the ayahuasca brew sets on much more slowly and will take you on a journey that can last up to 4 hours.
And so was it a little isolated patch in the Amazon? Like, how did you get there, and how did you arrange for people
to
meet you?
Well, my first experiences with ayahuasca were indeed in the Amazon jungle. Went down to the town of Iquitos and then went out by riverboat into the deep jungle and drank with shamans there.
Yeah.
Stayed on a little homestead for several days, my first encounters. Altogether, I had 11 sessions with ayahuasca in the Amazon jungle. That was my research project.
Yes.
I found the experiences so incredibly valuable to me and so transformatory of my life that I decided to continue working with ayahuasca and to make it a regular spiritual exercise as far as possible. So I've tried to have 5 ayahuasca sessions a year every year since then, and usually we go to a retreat in southern Brazil run by a friend of mine who is very experienced with
and
the brew.
What happens when you take this brew?
Well,
what happened to you? Sorry, what happened?
I think one can generalize to a certain extent from what happens to me, also happens to others, is that the brew does make you nauseous. I found as I've increased my experience of the brew that I don't vomit particularly, but typically a new drinker will vomit during the ayahuasca session several times, may well have diarrhea as well. This is the effect of the ayahuasca vine, which is called the purge in the Amazon. You might get sweaty, you might feel a little dizzy and disoriented. The physical effects are quite disturbing. But once you deal with those, there are profound transformations of consciousness that occur, and the sense of being plunged into a seamlessly convincing a parallel realm, more real than real, if you like, where you are likely to encounter intelligent entities who communicate with you telepathically. It's a two-way interaction. You're having an interaction with these entities, and once you've experienced those entities, it's possible to understand what the ancient Greeks meant by the gods, or the ancient Egyptians meant by the gods. It's like encountering an incredibly powerful force.
And is there a physical aspect to them that you can describe, or is it not really that?
They are shapeshifters. The entity that I've most commonly met, I construe as the spirit of ayahuasca, and I always encounter her in female form, and so do many others. And typically in the West, she's being called Mother Ayahuasca or the grandmother father in Western circles these days. She doesn't only appear in female form. Amongst some Amazon tribes, she appears in male form. So this is an entity that can take any form, sometimes as a human woman, sometimes as a jaguar, sometimes as a gigantic serpent. I've met her most often in the serpent form, but never been in any doubt who I'm meeting or what is involved here. And what is involved is a powerful teaching from an entity that is fundamentally benign. I construe her as the mother goddess of the planet who has time to take an interest in each of us as individuals. And I understand that science can say that all of this is just projection of my brain on drugs. And perhaps it is. Who knows? But that's not how I experience it, and it's not how countless others who've worked with ayahuasca experience it. It feels very much like a real encounter, as real as you and I talking here.
And when she was in the form of or had characteristics of a serpent, why were you not fearful? Like, what? Why was it still?
Never felt afraid of the ayahuasca serpent form at all, because the energy that she projects is benign and positive. It's a loving energy. It's tough love sometimes, showing you things about yourself you might not want to know, teaching you lessons about yourself you might not want to hear. But there's no doubt at all in my mind that the source of those lessons is love.
So does she say specific things about your life, or is it more general things that you then have to later go away and go, ah, she was saying a broad point about that, and the way I associate it with my life is I've got to be nicer to my wife?
It's more showing you your life. I mean, for example, the single greatest transformation that ayahuasca has worked with me was causing me to stop completely after 24 years a non-stop cannabis habit. I had been smoking cannabis for 24 years, and in the last 11 years or so had been smoking it all day long, every day. In fact, vaporizing it. I switched over to a vaporizer rather than combustion products. And I don't mean to put cannabis down, because cannabis can itself be a wonderful healing ally, and I personally received a lot of benefits from my relationship with cannabis. But my relationship with cannabis was the problem, not cannabis itself. And the relationship became abusive and vast overuse of the herb, which led me to paranoid tendencies in me. I became very suspicious, very untrusting of other people, and this made my behavior increasingly negative. And I was shown this in very graphic way in the ayahuasca visions. From the very moment I started to drink, the very moment I started to drink ayahuasca in 2003, I was shown scenes that questioned my relationship with cannabis, but I ignored them. In 2011, I was given just the most powerful kicking and psychic beating up over cannabis, that when I went back to England after those five sessions in Brazil, I actually couldn't smoke cannabis again. If somebody told me 2 weeks before I went down to Brazil that I would not be smoking cannabis again, I would have laughed in their face, because my relationship was so intense. But actually, it stopped. And certainly, I feel better as a result of that. I'm not filled with suspicion and jealousy and paranoia anymore. And my fear that I wouldn't be able to write without cannabis has proved to be groundless. In fact, I'm much more productive as a writer now than I was before. So this has been a healing for me. And I say that without putting cannabis down. I want to be clear about that. Others can have extremely positive relationships with cannabis, can be beneficial for them. My problem was my relationship with the herb, not the herb itself.
And when you said scenes from your life were shown, is that like quite literal? Or
yes, quite literal.
See yourself.
I recollect a scene where perhaps I've been deeply unpleasant to my wife,
yep,
which previously I have rationalized to myself as perfectly justifiable behavior. The shouting, the yelling, the accusations, the unpleasantness. And suddenly, in vision, I see that scene as it really was, with me just being absolutely obnoxious in a completely unforgivable way, and that the only solution to that is to stop doing that. You know, you can't go back and change what you've done in the past, but you can change what you do in the future. And the problem in altering deeply ingrained habits is having the motivation to do so. And what those ayahuasca sessions gave me was the motivation to change that behavior. And central to that for me was stopping smoking cannabis.
And were you outdoors when you took the brew, or were you inside?
No, I was indoors on that particular occasion. I've also taken it outdoors in the Amazon jungle. The setting is interesting; it has interesting effects, but it doesn't really matter where you drink it, actually.
And do you take it alone, or is it there like
always? Take it in a group.
Yeah,
I've only once drunk ayahuasca with just one other person. Normally, it's with a dozen or so. And the group setting is important as well, because the following day you're going to have a sharing, you're going to share the experiences you've had. Then you get a sense of the unity of mankind, the fact that we all undergo these experiences, that we all have our personal demons, that we all have issues in our lives that we need to resolve, and that ayahuasca is playing a role in showing us those things. But I do need to emphasize that all is not sweetness and light in the ayahuasca garden. Ayahuasca opens us psychically to realms beyond this realm, I believe. I understand that a mainstream scientist would say that that's all complete bullshit and it's just our brain on drugs. Yeah. I don't think it's that, but I accept their point of view as also a valid point of view. I think it opens us psychically to other realms, and in those other realms, there are entities that are negative as well as entities that are positive. Just as in this realm, there are negative and positive people, and the choices we make are what define us.
But are those negative characters, are you only seeing them as visions, or are they actually there so you could be under threat?
I've had experiences in ayahuasca sessions where individuals join, I mean people like you and I,
yeah.
Who join the sessions because the vulnerability that ayahuasca creates allows them to gain psychic power over others. This is a growing phenomenon in ayahuasca circles, and it's a warning I would make to anybody drinking ayahuasca, is be careful, choose who you're drinking with. Because there are people joining ayahuasca sessions who are joining those sessions purely so that they can act as psychic vampires, so that they can draw the energy of others and work harm on others. There is a tradition of sorcery in the Amazon, as well as a tradition of healing. The curanderos are the healers, the brujos are the sorcerers, and both make use of ayahuasca. Ayahuasca is best regarded in this sense, I think, as a power. In order to gain access to that realm, you need to drink ayahuasca.
And so what do the sorcerers use it for? If the
to
healer...
attack others, to attack, to kill, to weaken, to destroy others. And again, the entrance to that other realm is necessary in order to do that from their point of view. So it's not all sweetness and light. I do believe at the heart of it is a benign and positive entity, but she is not all powerful. And in order to gain access to her field of force, you are also exposed to other fields of force. And that's ultimately where human choice comes down to it. You have to choose against the darkness and for the light. You have to make those choices. And there are some who choose the darkness and close themselves to the light.
But if I understood you, the benign force can show you dark things, but that's also for your own benefit, because didn't you say you were
yes.
taken into actual hell?
Well, I don't believe in hell, but a terrifying place where appalling things are done to you. The best metaphor for that is hell.
Yes.
And yes, I was indeed taken into a sort of hell world, and shown that if I continued on the path I was going, that would be my spiritual destiny.
And what did the hell look like?
It was a place where I was taken apart, disassembled, ripped to pieces by small beings that ran around me and just tore me to pieces, torn to shreds. And also revealed in absolute truth everything about me. Nothing hidden, nothing secret. All of it open. All of it exposed.
And
shown that our opportunity in this life is to correct the mistakes that we've made in the past, and to live a life in such a way that when we come to that moment of death, that we can face it with a certain honesty and purity. That's the important mm-hmm. thing to do.
Do you have a question before
the mother culture? Before we leave, that's all I wanted to know.
Yes,
the mother culture.
What mother culture?
That guides the universe.
I don't know about a mother culture.
Well, the that liquid itself.
The ayahuasca brew.
Yeah, it seems to indicate, doesn't it, that we are in the presence of a feminine.
Yes,
that's
certainly. Certainly, in the you confuse me by calling it a culture.
Yeah, no.
Of a feminine energy.
Yes.
A feminine force.
Yes.
That's how it might. But I did emphasize that for some tribes in the Amazon, the spirit of ayahuasca manifests as male. I think this is a taking of form that is most effective for the person who receives it. And for us in the West these days, it's most effective to receive that form as a feminine energy.
Because in the desert religions, I'm saying that in fact there was the old knowledge that in fact God was not only male, but also that there was a feminine presence.
By desert religion, do you mean the Jews, the Christians?
Pre-Jew.
Now, Graham Hancock, your tour is pretty much sold out, except for Perth.
Yeah, we've taken a bigger venue in Perth because they sold out the previous venue, so there's some seats left in Perth.
That's at the Riverside Theatre on the 24th of May. You can go to grahamhancocktour.com.au, and you're going all over Australia too, but alas, sold out.
Yeah, that's in Melbourne and Sydney and Brisbane and Byron.
Thank you so much for joining us, Graham Hancock. And dear listeners, you're listening to Triple J.
You're listening to Sunday Night Safran on Triple J.
Hey, Father Bob.
Yeah, I flew in a small aeroplane. Yeah, to Mount Gambier and back. First time in 80 years.
In 80 years?
80 years. Never been in a tiny aeroplane with two seats for me and me mate. And then had to have the seats rearranged or our positioning because, as the nice man discreetly said, because otherwise we will be unbalanced. See what I mean? Because in the old days, well, apparently the human passenger was something like 80 kilos.
Mm.
Now he was confronted with 120 kilos.
You're 120?
110, I'm saying.
Are you 110?
I'm admitting to 110.
But are you 120?
I can't say anything.
Fair enough.
So the other guy who was less than that, but we had to fancy being told that. We can't take off until you, the fat one, is positioned in this tiny cockpit. John, why didn't you tell me about all the perils of flying in a tiny aeroplane?
The two things. Thing number one, I read an article in the Herald Sun about how the coffin building industry is having to adjust in Australia because...
Fat.
Yeah, you know I can't. I've been banned.
You couldn't say that. I can say it because I'm one of them.
But I was. When I put on 15 kilograms in Mississippi, then I lost it. Doesn't that entitle me?
No.
You know what I mean?
No. You're a faux fatty. Come on. What are you talking about?
Listen, I've been banned from talking about any fat-related issues because I come across as fatphobic. So
you've given it up, and therefore you've become a zealous evangelist.
I can just report on this coffin thing in a straight way with no little quips or remarks. So, they're having to do things such as tell the mourners that they're not allowed to carry the coffin because it's like a health risk.
Health and safety.
So it's like it's too heavy or whatever.
It fell on them.
And the other thing is they have to bury it closer to the gates of the cemetery.
Why? Like, in case somebody gets out.
No, because like they can't carry it as far.
Because of the health and safety.
Yes, it's just whole. And then on top of it, you know how you always have to be sensitive about...
I can imagine you'd be sensitive about issues.
About issues.
You'd make a great undertaker.
Do you reckon I'd be a good...
The journalism's finished.
Yeah, I can become an under.
I reckon.
Yeah.
If you want an outrageous funeral, dial Safran.
Yeah, no, I think I'd be okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Of course. Top hat. But listen, I'm telling you, the other thing was worse.
I'd be a hipster undertaker.
Exactly.
I'd wear the whole... I'd wear the top hat and everything.
Exactly. I get in the seat, and then, of course, we have to strap ourselves in. Guess what, folks? The strap is not long enough. The safety belt won't do up, Father, because Father is so, what will I say, corpulent. So they struggle, they dismantle the aeroplane almost. It's true. Until this wretched belt could be. And by that time, of course, my eyes have popped out. They're on the windscreen.
Anyway,
we got to Mangambria and back.
Because you know that the gaps that are left, like the plots that are left to dig up.
Yes.
They've been a certain measurement forever, yes. And the whole cemetery has been plotted around that. But now, because of the corpulency in the community,
don't go on. Yes,
that's another reason. Like people aren't fitting in those gaps of the plots.
Well, they're saying
so they're having to go on the end.
They tried vertical burials, so they could go plop like that in rows.
Yep.
Instead of taking up all of that space, you see.
Did we talk about how apparently there's an Aboriginal burial manor? I don't know which amongst the Aborigines do it, where you get buried. Oh, you get left next to a tree. That's right. And then like all the flesh goes away, and there's this bones. And the bones are put into a kangaroo something.
What a skin. A pelt.
And then they put that...
Oh, that's nice.
...into the tree, so you become part of the tree.
Oh, that's nice. I like all that.
I reckon that'd be pretty good. I'd like that to happen.
Or your Buddhist friends who take the corpse, don't they, and put it up on the open hillside so that the whatever they are fly around and that.
Vultures.
Yes, thank you. I wasn't going to name them in case somebody felt embarrassed. Pick, 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 until... The bones are left, and you've returned to Mother Earth.
That's how you could solve the problem with the corpulent corpses and not being able to fit. You leave them out there for the vultures for a while.
We can't do that. This is Australia, for God's sake. We're not going to do any of those things.
And I forget what number two is. Remember I said one?
Yeah.
And so there's OCD. You can imagine our listenership, a lot of them are... like OCD, and so they've been waiting there
for the
number
two.
Number two, it's like Safran said, number one. I'm afraid I've forgotten. Oh well, dear listeners, you're listening to Triple J,
Sunday Night Safran
with John Safran and Father Bob Maguire on Triple J.
Up next, I'll get some non-religious expertise on driving out demons.
This is Sunday Night Safran with me, John Safran, and Father Bob Maguire. Joining us now is Robert Bruce, an astral traveller and spiritual guide who is an expert on demons. Hey, Robert, how are you?
G'day, mate. How are you?
Good, good, good. Where are you right now?
I'm in Perth at the moment, in West Australia.
So probably a good starting point, because as well as being an expert and having tips on how to get rid of demons, you were possessed yourself about 25 years ago?
Yes, and that's what led me into it.
What happened?
Well, I became possessed. I was helping a number of people in a small town that were suffering major spiritual problems. And during a healing session with a five-year-old boy and his mother, in exasperation, I said, literally, it just popped into my head, I said, take me and leave the child. And it did.
Wow.
Instantly. It was like getting hit by a boxer. And that led me to a saga of several weeks where I was progressively losing control of my body. And eventually I spent like 2 weeks out in the wilderness, up out in the hills, starving and, fasting and almost died of thirst many times. But during the process, I was led to a place where I was... sleeping directly on top of an underground stream of water, and after a couple of days there, that did the trick, and that released me from the possessing spirit. And after a number of other experiences over the years, several years later, I put it all together, and I realized that the majority of spirits in the world that trouble people are, you could say, earthbound type spirits, earth element type spirits. They cannot cross running water.
And just winding back even further than that, you said you were in a small town helping people with spiritual problems. And why was that? Like, what's your backstory? Are you a priest? What's your tradition?
No, I'm just a lay person. I got into spiritual healing through a spiritualist movement my parents used to go to when I was about 20 years old. And over the years, I've learned a lot
And what was the spiritual movement your parents were into?
Just basic spiritualist, church-type movement, Christian spiritualist.
And is that continued thread in your work and your belief system? So do you think, for instance, demons are like demons as in the ones in the Bible?
Well, I don't really follow any religion or movement. I learned many years ago to go my own way and make my own observations. And I base my work entirely upon what works because I don't have time for anything that doesn't work. So I try not to have any kind of religious bias or follow any holy book. I mean, I've tried to death using prayers and things out of the Bible and various other holy books and that, and we had very little success. And it wasn't until I discovered my countermeasures in my book, Practical Psychic Self-Defense Handbook, which is available for any good bookstore or as an ebook, that I started making progress. And based upon the first breakthrough I made where they could not cross running water, I studied running water and various types of it and developed a range of countermeasures based on practical things that anybody could do for themselves.
So may I ask you where the demons come from?
Like, I don't know.
Or you don't know. So from your perspective, no. It's just there are these bad spiritual forces and the backstory for why they're there is sort of that's not kind of what you're into.
No, well, I mean, I could theorize easily here. I mean, as far as I'm concerned, I mean, there are good spirits and there are bad spirits. And you know them by their fruits, by their actions, by what they do. Now, unfortunately, most of my interactions with spirits have been with the bad type, the type that cause harm to people. And whether they're, you know, possessing a house, poltergeist and things like that, or whether they are interfering with children, as they often do, or adults. I've developed my countermeasures, which are not based on any belief system or anything, based on practical countermeasures.
To get a bad spirit attached to you in the first place, do you have to leave yourself open to it? Because I guess, like religious people say, you know, if you do bad deeds or do bad things, that's what's sort of like opening you up to them. But has that been your experience, or is it just that there's these bad spirits?
No, that's actually very wrong thinking. It's commonly believed to go today in the whole, you could say, New Age spiritual movement that like attracts like, and that if a spirit or bad spirit is attracted to a person, there must be something in that person which is attracting that spirit. Now, where that philosophy falls down is when you're working with children, particularly babies. Now, I've worked with babies 6 months old, 9 months of age, pre-language age. Now, babies of that age are incapable of language. They're incapable of having any bad thoughts. You know, can we agree on that?
Sure.
Now, no matter how you serve that up, you have an innocent baby there that is suffering the symptoms of possession or psychic attack. And by the symptoms here, I mean they are rigid, they are screaming, terrified little babies. And I prove that it is a spiritual condition because I walk them over running water, or I put, you know, garden hose on the ground, or I take them into a shower. And the instant they cross that garden hose, there's gushing water on the ground. The instant you cross that, the babies go limp, screaming stopped, and it's goo goo ga ga, and they're usually asleep in 30 seconds. Now, if you take one step back over that garden hose again, the baby will scream and go rigid again. And you can go backwards and forwards, pain, no pain, pain, no pain. It's predictable. That tells you that you have a dangerous attacking spirit there. And then I have other countermeasures for demanifesting them.
So one of the measures is water. And so that's is it so if someone's got a demon in them or they think is like jumping into the shower, is that a good thing?
Yes. Now, you will find if you are under a spiritual attack by even the most powerful entities, if you jump in the shower, it will stop instantly. Now, when you leave the shower again, it will start up again. if it's a higher order being, because it'll be waiting for you outside the shower. But getting into the shower is the first thing you do, because it gives you time to think and come up with a plan, because it's extremely debilitating if you come under a powerful psychic attack. You'll barely be able to walk. Now, this is also why sometimes you find people who are suffering from a psychotic episode, you will find them under the shower and they may have been there all day or all night, because they know they feel better when they're under the shower. Their mind is normal. But if they get out of it again, all the crazy stuff starts up again. There's some evidence there that some types of mental illness are caused by these entities.
So what do you do? You're under the shower, and what are some of the plans of action you have to take once you leave the shower?
Well, the first thing you need to do is to get out of the house, because these things don't travel very well. And by leaving the house there, you will delay it. Go sleep in a hotel, sleep in your car, go to a friend's house. That will give you some respite. But you absolutely need to get a copy of my book, which is called The Practical Psychic Self-Defense Handbook, because it has the quick start guide instructions in there, what we're talking about now, things you can do straight away. Because if something like this happens, it generally comes on very suddenly, and you don't have time to think. And in that state, it's difficult to read even a page of a book because your mind is so unbalanced. So I've got the quick start guide instructions in there. Just follow these directions. Get in the shower, leave the house, blah, blah, blah. You know, follow these in order.
Because I just read this line here. Like you were, it says here that when you were under attack, it drove you to hopelessness. You thought you were about to become an axe murderer, and you woke up in your child's nursery with a shotgun.
Yep. Yeah, I did. And that was when I knew I couldn't trust myself any longer. I mean, I had no experience with this beforehand, even though I'd seen it in other people I've been helping, but I never really connected. But that was when I left home and I went to my mother's old house and stayed there alone until I got some, you could say, advice. I was trying to connect with my higher self, some advice to help to save my sorry ass at the time. And I did get the advice, even though it sounded crazy, and that led me into the hills of Jarrahdale out in the Australian wilderness. And after about a week, I was going from place to place, and I ended up being led to a place where I was sleeping on top of an underground stream of water, which was coming down out of the hills. And that was what did the trick. Now, years later...
You talk about other things that have worked, such as chili powder and sulfur powder. Well, how did you find that out? Was that just by trial and error, or was that like you learned that from some tradition?
Well, I learned that from people. The chili powder, it comes from an Indian tradition, magical tradition called Puja. Puja? Puja magic. Now, this is like old wives' tales and that they follow in India, whereby they use burned chili powder or granules of chili, and they use that to smudge a person, to like smoke, put the smoke over a person or an object or through the house. And now that's swim goggles and a wet towel job, because chili is pretty rough. These days I start with frankincense incense, which is pretty effective at driving away bad spirits. And 95% of household disturbances can be solved by fumigating the house thoroughly using frankincense. If that doesn't work, you move to chili powder, and as a last resort, you move to sulfur powder, which gives off a poisonous gas. You need to be very careful to vacate the house and give it time to breathe using a sensor. But that will get rid of just about anything if you have a household disturbance where a spirit has moved into a house, like a poltergeist or something. And these countermeasures will get rid of 95% of it.
Dear listeners, Robert Bruce is an astral traveller and spiritual guide. And is the name of the book Practical Psychic Self-Defense?
Yeah, the Practical Psychic Self-Defense Handbook.
Handbook.
And you can find that if you go to my website, which is astraldynamics.com.
Thank you so much for joining us with all that great advice, Robert Bruce.
Sunday Night Saffron on Triple J.
Father Bob.
Yes, sport.
I was reading this article about poverty porn by a person interested in filmmaking, a writer called Tom Ronston. And it's like this opposite. And anyway, I'll just This is what he says. Once upon a time, documentary filmmakers went to impoverished places in America and around the world and did so because they wanted to change the world, bring attention to the disadvantaged, and ultimately help them.
Yes.
They made what we called social issue films. But nowadays there's a new breed of filmmakers who go to similar impoverished peoples or down and dirty places to make art. These filmmakers are storytellers first. And but he says that sort of like that's a bad thing, which is sort of like, anyway, it's impressionistic, he's talking about the films. You get a vivid sense of what life is like for people in these impoverished places, but the films are apolitical. See, I'd be like the opposite of him.
Yes.
Like, he's presenting all this stuff like, oh, there's filmmakers who make things for art and not, like, hammering you over the head with, you know, this is a political thing.
Yes.
And that's, like, a good thing. Yeah. But he's, like, the opposite.
Yeah, I'm the opposite.
You're the opposite of what? You think you think everything should be overtly social?
No, it won't, won't work.
And it's sort of like a false... What's that thing they say in first-year uni students say all the time? A false dichotomy?
Oh, you saw that.
So it's like making out if something's presented as art without sort of like some hectoring voiceover.
Yes. It's more subtle. Like,
yeah, some hectoring, earnest, syrupy voiceover that somehow... people aren't going to connect with it or blah. And anyway, so his thing is, I've heard this type of thing before, actually, where he's saying that, like, a fund should be set up for if a filmmaker goes into a place and so, therefore, the people of the place benefit from whatever the thing is, right?
Yes, indeed.
Oh, okay, good idea. Good idea, mate. I'm going to visit some white supremacists who live in poverty in the Deep South. They live in incredible... So I set up a fund for them? Do I? Or not? Or not? But they're poor. And you say I'm going into this... you know, this person just hasn't thought the whole thing through. The I was once on a panel at this Adelaide documentary conference, and it was about... The starting point is that documentary makers and story, like, we're the most, like, we've got the worst intention. So society has to be protected from us, right? So then there was one person on the panel say, oh, there should be this code of conduct set up that all documentary filmmakers has to live by or whatever. And like, and their example, that they said, you know what should have to happen is you sign this code of conduct and documentary filmmakers have to put up all the rushes of all the, of everything they shot up on this website so people can, yes, they can watch the documentary as you cut it, but documentary filmmaker, you're not going to get away with it anymore because we're also going to put up all the rushes so people can see how you've manipulated things. And, of course, all the zombies in the audience clapped, oh, what a great idea. And so I'm thinking, oh, when I've shot stuff, there's been scenes like you go to, like, some third world country and you have these... small children, like, coming up and sort of like hitting you up for money, and it's quite a demeaning thing that's being shot.
Yes.
And it's like, and it's showing these people at their desperate worst, in inverted commas, in scenes they would not want to be put up on the internet to be shown.
Yes.
So what happens? Do we put that up? Do you put up images?
It's hard to know because we're referring it to these days too as social pornography.
Sure. But you see, this is they've got the wrong end of the stick. Mm. Like sometimes when you cut things down, you're taking out things that are, like, demeaning.
Yeah, and true, and true. You can do that. That would be the art of telling people the truth about what's happening.
Oh, and then the other thing, of course, was at this documentary conference, it was about how you have to be very straight with all your subjects and let them know in advance what your angle is, and then... they get to see it at the end, or, like, you're not allowed to then, you know, if they say something they're uncomfortable with, they should be able. And so I, of course, interrupted. I said, oh, that's very interesting. So I'm going to be interviewing, I'm going to go interview members of the Liberal Party, and I'm going to, I'll give them advance notice exactly what I'm doing. And they can have final cut on what we want. And if they say something that's, you know, presents them in a way that's hypocritical, I won't put that in my final documentary because, like, we've all signed your little thing where you know, that the subjects of your documentary are king. And they get to, and, of course, she spluttered and that was sort of like. Anyway, basically, I'm right. And all these people are wrong. That's the end point of that.
Well, you can't. If you're not, if you don't want to, or you're not allowed to,
what?
Go into the streets and take pictures like a war correspondent of real poor people.
Mm.
You may in fact like to go and simulate on the street with actors.
Oh, is that your solution?
I've seen it done. A little boy standing up, he's an actor.
Yeah.
With a placard saying, "Please help a homeless kid."
Oh, is that that thing on YouTube?
Yes, and they all walk past.
Yep.
Whereas if you hold, get the kid, hold up, walk up the street with the bloke with a sandwich board on saying, "F the poor."
Yeah.
Everybody stopped and wanted to engage in conversation. See?
Mm.
Now what the... We fade out now to the sounds of... He's not heavy, he's my brother.
The
well produced.
The what? We've got to go now.
We've got to go now. I think that's we've hit the bottom.
The no. We've just run out of minutes.
Oh no, thank you.
You've been in top form.
Let's thank our guests from tonight, Graham Hancock.
Thanks, Graham.
Best-selling investigative author, etc. Robert
I reckon on the podcast.
Mm.
Imagine drinking ayahuasca whilst listening to the Graham Hancock interview or this entire show. I reckon this show would be great on ayahuasca.
You reckon?
Yeah, I might go home and download the podcast.
Think? I'd go down to your local store and see if they've got any on the shelf.
And I'll lie there in the forest or otherwise. Let's face it, I'll start off with these big dreams of taking ayahuasca in the forest whilst listening to the podcast.
Right.
But I'll just end up getting drunk on scotch.
Yeah, I'm dissociating
in my flat,
myself from any
collapsing
of these comments,
like I did
way.
With 7 weeks on True
Anybody
Detective.
Anybody out there is listening, I'm having nothing whatsoever to do with these recommendations.
You can keep in touch with us via...
What about Vladimir?
Oh, Vladimir. Thank you, Dr. Vladimir
With
Dubai.
The neuroscientist.
You can keep in touch with us via our Twitters, at Father Bob or at John Safran.
Mm-hmm.
You can also tweet our producer, at...
Right Eye.
It says
WRIGHTEYE.
We have a Scottish producer in at the moment.
We'll jump onto Sunday Night Safran. A Serpa went to Gallipoli.
Has she come back? Was she?
I don't know whether she's
I dead. Think she was like, or did, was she, is she a fallen?
No, she may have.
She's
she,
like the first person to be
no,
taken out in conflict in Gallipoli.
No. She's probably back and recovering. And don't forget the podcast will be up for you tomorrow morning. Grab it from triplej.net.au/Safran.
iTunes.
Or SoundCloud. And that's it from us. Catch you next week, kiddies.
Bye-bye.